Most people who have a passion for golf appreciate history and the tradition of the game. But one of the main differentiators between the Sticks and Hacks is when it comes to golf course management and strategy. Today, we're going to talk golf course architecture, which impacts both, here at the Business of Golf. Welcome in. I'm Allison Johnson. Thanks for joining us here at the Business of Golf on the Stick and Hack Network. I'm here with Adam Grubb. Adam, how's your game going so far this season?
It's the exact same as it's been for 25 years. Thank you so much for asking. And this topic is exciting for me because this is something that I have struggled with, that most golfers struggle with, but it is fixable. There are some things in golf that are not fixable. And this is, and so I'm very excited to talk with Brad here in just a second.
Well, I feel like people either, they have a rich understanding about different golf course architects and what that means when it comes to the course and how to play it, or they just appreciate that it's pretty and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I played recently with a woman, we were in the same cart, and she said, "Who designed this course?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know." And she said, "Was it Crenshaw?" And I said, "I don't know. Let me look it up." So I looked it up, and lo and behold, it was. And I got to tell you, I was a little mind boggled that just by driving it, she was like, "Oh, I know who built this course," because that is not my skill set. So I'm excited for Bradley Klein to join us today. Brad is one of those people that you meet him and you're just wowed by everything that he knows and has forgotten about the industry because he's done so many incredible things within this space. So he was a PGA Tour caddy for 10 years. Then he went into academia, left academia, and became a full-blown, well-regarded golf journalist. So author of 7 books on golf course architecture. He's worked at Golf Week magazine, Golf Channel, GolfAdvisor.com. I read somewhere that he's published over 1,500 articles.
Holy cow.
In the golf space. I mean, we've got somebody joining us today that is legit, and I'm really excited. He earned the 2015 Donald Ross Award for Distinguished Lifetime Achievement from the American Society of Golf Course Architects, and he's a design consultant on dozens of golf course projects, primarily restorations, which is how we met, which we're going to get a little into in a little bit. But Brad, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm one of those guys, when I do a drive-by and a down the road, I look at the bunker and I can tell you who designed it and who rebuilt it and who the shaper was, so.
The shaper. There's an actual person that shapes bunkers. Is that a job?
Yeah, it's actually a great job if you like being outdoors all day sitting on a 12-ton bulldozer.
Wild. Just
that is
wild.
That's crazy.
They all make $100,000 a year right now. So, yeah, it's not bad.
Absolutely incredible. So, Brad, we met, to set the stage here, we met on a restoration project that you were doing with Jerry Pate at the Country Club of Mobile in Alabama. And right before our big media day and reveal, and we got an award, all this great stuff, we went out on the course together so that you could show me the changes that were made and why it was important. And I got to tell you, I've been on golf courses my entire adult life. I have never seen them through the lens that you gave me, which was incredible. So one of the things that I read that you were quoted saying, which I thought kind of summarized all that and I'd like to talk about a little bit, was 90% of the golf course is invisible to the golfer. So talk a little bit with us about what does that mean and what comes into account when you're playing?
Well, first of all, I think part of the problem that golf architecture has, it's a very esoteric trade. It's really only appreciated by 5 or 10% of golfers because they think it's a big mystery. It's not. There are two principles, and these are all you need to know. The first one, as you stated, Allison, is that 90% of what it takes for the golf course to work, you can't see. So when I talk to committees and members and boards and all that, one of the first things I try to tell them is they have no idea what they're talking about because they've never seen what's working. You've got miles of pipe. You've got miles of electrical wire. You've got drainage. You've got root structure. You have soil chemistry. All that's below ground. If that's not working, the golf course doesn't work. So if you don't understand that, you really don't really know what you're talking about. So from a technical standpoint, that rules out most people, and it puts the practice in the hands of experts. The second thing is that all you really need to know in order to appreciate architecture is that golf course architecture is what happens when the ball hits the ground. It's going to go somewhere. It's either going to go plop or it's going to go roll. And it's going to roll in the direction of the slope. So when you're playing a golf course, if you just think about not just the distance, but the shape of the land and where the ball is going to wind up, and you play accordingly, you are now playing golf course architecture. That's it. Everything else follows from that.
He makes it sound so simple.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, let's back up a second, Brad, okay?
Well, that's 50 years of wisdom boiled down into two sentences.
Right. And exactly. I've known about this for 5 minutes, so allow me to dig into this a little bit. So I've been lucky enough to play some really cool courses, and I'm lucky enough to be a member at a club that is a Pete Dye design course, and that's all they talk about, right?
Which course is that?
I'm in Harbor Trees in Noblesville, Indiana. And okay. So right in near his hometown of Carmel. So a peat course, you have these couple little things that every peat course has. But I've been lucky enough to play a couple courses where the story of the golf course architecture and design was really the reasons that we were there and the experience, it heightened the experience. For instance, Oakmont, everything goes into the bunker. Everything slopes and rolls to the bunker. It was designed that way, according to the caddy at the point. At least my balls all went into the bunker. I don't know if that's supposed to be that way. But tell me about that. So when somebody is designing a course, are they thinking legitimately about where the ball could be, should be, or probably will be, and what happens to it afterwards? Explain that to me from a mental perspective, how a golf course architect is actually thinking years in advance and to every level of golfer that could play that course. That's mind-boggling.
That they're all thinking exactly that way. So the first thing is you're thinking about is you've got different mowing heights. And what's great about modern architecture is that because the mowing heights are so precise, more so than could have been the case when Oakmont was built in 1903, for example. When Oakmont was built in 1903, fairways were cut to 3/4 of an inch, maybe once a week. The greens were 1/4 of an inch. Ball didn't roll a whole lot. Now those greens are cut to 1/10 of an inch. The fairways are cut to 4/10 of an inch. The rough is manicured to 2, 2.5, 3 inches. So you've got different textures. That's what you think about. You think about playing textures. The main playing texture, which is tee fairway green, that ball is rolling like crazy. So the first thing you think about is, where's the ball going? Now at Oakmont, I know it well. I caddied there in the 78 PGA and the 83 Open, been back many times. I was there for the 2006. When Dustin Johnson won in 2018, I was there. The ball's rolling like crazy. And what's really crazy about Oakmont is that the greens are falling away from you and the approaches into the green from the fairway are rolling away from you. So the ball's constantly rolling out of control. So what you have to figure out is not only the distance in the air, but what's going to happen when the ball rolls out and how far. So there are a lot of shots at Oakmont. On the first hole, for example, you got to land the ball 20 yards short. And it's designed that way. And now it finally plays that way because the mowing heights are so precise. So there are two things that a golf architect is always thinking about. The first thing is actually drainage. All they're trying to do is get water off the main surface so the surface can be dry. And the only way to get that is to create roll on the side. You don't want water pouring onto the green. It just soaks the green and it saturates the area and it doesn't make it play well. You want a fast and firm surface. So the architect is first thinking about get the water off the surface, but then provide a little bit of careful steering ground so you can aim the ball. So a well-placed shot, the way to put it is that the beauty of a well-designed golf course is that it's not just where the ball lands, but where it ends up. And Oakmont is a fantastic example of how incredibly difficult it is to control the ball when it's moving away from you. So now on every hole at Oakmont, as an example, not only are the greens pitched and the approaches pitched away, which helps drainage, but on the side of probably 12 holes, there are these deep ditches 6-8 feet left and right in the rough that also collect water. You miss the shot slightly. I guess we got to be careful here on X-rated. You're screwed. So you're thinking of all the time. You're playing in a state of sort of permanent terror because you know it's hard enough to play golf and put the ball on the club face. Now you got to put it in a spot, and if it goes a little out of the way, you're messed up. Every architect thinks about that. Every architect thinks about the distance part is easy. Anytime I talk to people and they're talking about golf architecture as distance, I know they're idiots because all they can think about is 7,000 yards or I hit a 4 iron 180 and it didn't stop. Because they don't understand the principle of what happens when the ball hits the ground. So architects are always thinking about, and Pete Dye was absolutely the best on that because he understood that water flowed down, it followed gravity. So the trick for Pete was always to provide a sort of a side channel, if you will, or a place on the side that the water would steer and the main playing surface would stay dry. And you got to keep your ball in that area. The other thing that Pete did is he provided a way for you to run the ball in, but it's a small spot because the green itself is generally perched up a touch
And
from the
about that
surrounds.
big. It's about every green is about 5 by 8. It's the
Well,
worst.
here's the other way to think about it. A golf course is 150 acres of uplands. The greens form 2, maybe 3 acres of upland surface. So it's a small percentage of the land mass, but it's the one that you're hitting, by definition, you're hitting 18 approaches, you're hitting probably 30, 36 putts, and then you're hitting recovery. Everything centers around the greens. You're approaching them, you're recovering them, you're putting on them. So 90% of the interest and strategy on a golf course is on and around the greens. And every architect thinks that way. And it's much easier to manipulate that 2, 3 acres of surface than the rest of the 150 acres. Because of that golf course, you've got 30 acres of fairway, say. And then you got 50 acres, 60 acres of rough, and then another 50, 60 acres of, native area that out on the side. So you're focusing all your attention as a designer on the character, presentation, and the contours of the greens. Now, the other thing that happens on the greens is that you have to maintain a pitch to the green. There's nothing more boring in golf than a dead flat surface. So you've got to create some contour, but because the ball is rolling so quickly, given modern mowing heights, an eighth of an inch, a tenth of an inch, this is the tricky part. You can't really build more than 3 or 4% of slope into the green. So you have all these laser measurements now that allow you to create pitch on the green of 1 or 2 or maybe 3%. And you can put the flag, the pin, cut the hole in a space that's 2% or less. If you put a flag cut on a slope of 3% or more, it's never the ball's not going to stop. So you've got all these angles and all these kind of considerations to think about, and that's what they do. That's why they get paid the money they do.
It's incredible. All these numbers. I'm not a math girl. I'm just hit it and go, right?
Well, there's a lot to that as well.
I'm
But
telling you.
if you didn't have that kind of precision, the golf course would be goofy, or it would be dull, or it would be repetitive, or you'd just be hitting aerial shots into greens that are protected by bunkers. But it's much more fun to have the option of rolling the ball on rather than flying it on. Good players, the people we watch on the LPGA or the PGA Tour, they can fly the ball in anywhere and stop it. They hit it with perfect spin, the trajectory, all that stuff. They have total control over the golf ball. They don't have as much control over the firmness of the ground when the ball lands. So the trick with contemporary skill players is to create a playing surface that's really firm and fast. And we saw that with the ocean course during the PGA last week when Mickelson won. In that wind, it's very hard to control what happens when the ball hits the ground. That's the whole skill. But you also have to create a landing area that is accessible to every skill level of golfer. Otherwise, only championship golfers are going to be able to play it. That's really hard. So you got to provide access in the front. Now, that might seem that you're making the golf course too easy for the scratch golfer, but the scratch golfer doesn't really play on the ground anyway. They play in the air. So they're playing a different golf course even when they're on the same golf course. They don't look at that as much. They try to get precision in terms of how they land the ball.
So then what's your take? This year I haven't heard it quite as much, but last year everybody was talking about the distance of the course and rolling back the ball and all that kind of stuff. So what I'm hearing you say is that's really not as valid of a conversation as people have made it out to be.
it's only affecting 1/100th of 1% of golfers. It only affects the tour player and the elite college golfer. I just to give you an example, it's a great example. I live in central Connecticut. I'm involved in the restoration of a Donald Ross course called Wampanoag. Kyle Franz is doing the help. Is doing it. I did the historical analysis. The golf course is 6,600 yards, par 72. The par fives are 490 to 550. The golf course is short by modern standards. There was a 15-mile-an-hour wind that blew for the 2 days of the Connecticut Section PGA, one over par one. 2 days. The winner shot 68-73. Nobody else broke par. So for most golf, and those are PGA club pros, you know, they're good players. They hit it 260, but they're not college golfers. They're not tour players, but they're good golfers. They're all scratch, one handicap, two handicap. 6,600 yards was fine for them because the wind blew and because the contour of the greens and the firmness makes it demanding no matter what. The tour player can always hit the drive 300 yards, but they still have to make a five-foot putt. And if the five-foot putt breaks from outside the hole, now they're kind of guessing a little bit, and they have to match line and speed. And if there's a little crosswind, now it gets more complicated. You know, a 10-mile-an-hour wind on a 10-foot putt doubles the break. So all of a sudden, you've got some quandary to deal with on what looks like a simple surface. So I think that the whole conversation about distance is irrelevant to 99.5% of players. And I also think that rolling back the ball, percentage-wise for everybody, would be a disaster because we're all looking for more distance because we all need it. So I think the USGA has got it all wrong in their focus on the elite, on distance, if they're trying to affect the elite player. There are ways to affect the elite player by not without affecting the average golfer, but that's a different set of standards that would be required. But a proportionate across-the-board rollback of the ball, I think, would be a disaster for the game.
Brad, let's talk quickly about the business here behind the golf architecture, right? So a lot of people don't realize, I know I don't, I'll just speak for the rest of Americans, that they don't know the true lineage between an architect, a golf course owner, a manager, to the pro, to the superintendent. There's so many people that are involved in a golf course on a day-to-day basis. But when a golf course architect designs a course to start, what is that process? Is he designing it to sell it? Is he selling his design, his or her design? Walk me through that, because I don't know how it even begins.
Again, very simple. You work for a client, and the client is the owner. So you, first thing you want to find out is who's going to play the golf course, and what do you want to do with it? So here's an example. An owner hires you in a competitive process bids against other people, and you win the bid for whatever reason, because of your track record, price, and all that. Here are things you need to know. Who's going to play it? Is this going to be for everyday play? Is it going to be member play? If it's member play, the golf course can be a little more complicated because they can learn it on a regular basis, and within a few rounds, they know what's going on. If it's public play, you have a more diverse client base. You have a lot more golfers who are playing it only once or twice. It can't be quite as hidden or intrigue. You can't have as much hidden golf shots, for example. That's one consideration. The second consideration is how much is the maintenance budget going to be? Because you have to mow the greens every day. You have to mow the faces of the bunkers twice a week. You got to mow the fairways three times a week. You got to mow the rough once a week. If you let that get out of hand, you're in trouble because now you've got flyer lies and the ball will never stop. So you need to know before you start, how much are you willing to pay for maintenance? The average maintenance on a golf course in the public sector is probably, it varies a lot, but let's just say it's going to be anywhere from $700,000 for a low-end golf course to $1.4 million for a private golf course. In the New York City area, it's close to $2 million. If you're out in northern Michigan, it's going to be a lot less. But you need to know how much are you willing to pay, what kind of equipment you have. Do you have, as an example, do you have walk mowers for the greens that are very precise in terms of how much contour they can handle, or do you have wider triplex mowers that require less labor? All those questions have to be asked ahead of time. Second question, who's going to operate it on a daily basis, not just maintain it, but who's going to be in control of it? Is it an owner who's trying to make money? Is it a real estate company that's trying to sell real estate? If you're using the golf course to sell real estate, you can get away with a bigger budget and you don't worry about the golf operation because that's a money loser, because it's very hard to make money on a golf course proper. You make it on the real estate. And 20% of all golf courses, 30% of all golf courses built in the last 20 years are real estate. So a lot of these courses, they're fancy, they require a lot of maintenance, but it doesn't matter because that's not where the profit is. The profit's going to be in the real estate. Now, what happens is a lot of these fancy courses that require a lot of hand maintenance, because it's very complicated surfaces and takes a lot of hand mowing and a lot of labor. After 12 years and the real estate's sold out and the membership takes over, all of a sudden they find out that they got to pay 1.7 million, and first thing they do is cut the budget to 1.1 million. Then the golf course starts looking like hell and people are very upset. So you need to know that in advance. You need to know all that. Here's the other thing you need to know. Does the golf course serve as a floodplain for the community? A big part of golf is basically it's a drainage basin. When there's a flood, if you get a big rain or a 100-year storm, the water in the community is going to go somewhere. You better make sure that it's going to go into low areas on the golf course that don't wash away tees, greens, and fairways. So you have to work with city engineers and municipal planners. And I've been in those meetings, and they are complicated. They are really complicated, particularly now with climate change and more frequent storms and higher levels of runoff. And then when you get into a suburban community where you've got a lot of buildup because you've got highways, schools, commercial, and hard surface, more and more water is going onto the golf course than was the case. A lot of these older courses get swamped because the conditions around the golf course have changed. The architect needs to know all of that in advance.
Yeah, you're right. That was simple. Sorry for the
That's
Hey, I think about this at the top of my swing, you know?
Oh God, that's not the time to be doing it. So I'm sure you have a lot of things running through your head. So with over 1,500 articles published, you know a
Something
lot
like that.
about
I
a
don't
lot.
count. The older I get, the shorter my resume, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Now I just write. I've written a lot of articles.
Well, so I'm curious, when you think about the history side of courses, which I know Adam's like a huge fan of, and a lot of people just find so interesting, what stands out to you is this is a really cool story.
I love older golf courses that were built by these curmudgeons. Most of them were kind of drunk and debaucherous guys who they didn't go
Sounds
to
like
meetings
golf
a
now
whole
still.
lot. Yeah.
It's gonna say
They
it's no different than it sounds like a stick and act member.
Yeah, well, that's probably they'd qualify. A lot of the great architects came into the game because they loved the game. Charles Blair MacDonald, A.W. Tillinghast, Seth Rayner, Donald Ross. They might have been good golfers, but what they really loved was interesting golf. And so they were building golf courses. Let's say most of them were built before 1930. Just take a number. Now, before 1930, they weren't using bulldozers. They were using hand labor, imported labor from certain, southern Mediterranean countries. And when you built the green, you had 50 guys with a wheelbarrow and they pushed dirt for a month. But they only built up the greens. They never contoured the fairways because you couldn't do it in those days. So what's great about the older golf courses is they sit on the natural terrain. And the skill set of the architect then was to find a natural routing, a sequence of holes that fit on the land where you didn't have to move the fairways. And all you really did was adjust those 2, 3 acres of land that would support the green. So their inventiveness and all of their skill set was really based on making sure the routing worked. And sometimes you had steep hills and blind shots and over the hill, but you also had things that looked really cool because they were shaped by the big guy upstairs rather than a guy sitting on a bulldozer. If you build a fairway, it's very simple. Drainage has been around for 40 million years. They figured that out 40 million years ago. where the water was going to go, right? The contour, the land, glaciers, erosion, everything. The water just moved off. And so the old architects found the high points and worked from there. The modern architect gets a little bit more tempted. There's not as much good land. You have to use landfill and all these different sites and to accommodate housing. So they're shaping and rebuilding and recontouring fairways with big earth-moving equipment. And the result is generally, it doesn't look as interesting because it was manufactured. Now, Pete Dye was one of the guys, really, who was able to use modern earth-shaping equipment to build golf courses that look really cool. And all he really did was cut down on the sides. He never built up. He cut down on the side. And the key to Pete Dye, actually, is he always hired shapers who had never been on a golf course. Because they weren't trying to build a golf course. They were just farm kids who grew up on equipment, and they were trying to get the job done as fast as possible and get the water clear. So they just kind of cut channels on the side. And Pete Dye courses, they look really cool because the land is down on the side, but the natural contour is still existing down the middle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's your point about the early courses and some of those architects is spot on. North Shore in Chicago, Bobolink are two very good examples of old courses that the greens are up and that's really where the scoring happens or doesn't happen, as it were. So that's interesting. I will ask you this though, as a parent myself, Allison's a parent. I'm sure you're a parent. We have these
grandparent. I'm a grandparent.
Well, there you go. We have these kids, right? We have these things that we create. And then they're awesome, and they're exactly as we want them to be for so many years. And then all of a sudden, they start to move this direction until they get older. And then you're like, "Who is this kid that I've been with?" Is there something like that with golf course architects that they had something in their head, they created it, and then 50 years later, all these people with their little opinions and their little ideas and all that stuff start creeping in, and now the course is very different. Tell me and talk to me about that. I know it's a long question, but we're into long-winded answers and questions here, so why not? Brad, tell me about that feeling when you first design a course, and then 50 years later it looks completely different.
I'll boil this down to three sentences to simplify everything, and you're absolutely right. The old architects used native terrain, and they were brilliant at putting bunkers in the upslopes. And they were wide open fields, and yet the ball was going a lot of different places, and you had a lot of different people who played the game kind of tic-tacking their way around. Modern architecture after 1960 discovered a couple of things. First of all, more and more people were hitting the ball in the air. Second, they discovered color television. Color television was started in the Bob Hope Classic, I think 1966 was like the first tournament ever televised. And all of a sudden people thought, oh, that's gorgeous. We got to colorize our golf course. So they started planting trees. And then they decided we got to have a tournament championship golf course, so we need back tees and we got to move the bunkers. And in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, all of those classical courses got put under a bulldozer by some green committee who wanted to make the golf course tougher, more beautiful. And they screwed up the whole history of architecture. And now what's happening is we're going back and discovering that the old guys had it right. So architects like Tom Doak, Gil Hands, Bill Corr, Ben Crenshaw, Mike DeVries, David Kidd have made a career out of basically saying, and others, basically saying, you know what, the old guys were right. Let's go back to that. So the kids ruined it. And now the next generation is fixing it. And so we're going back to that. We're taking out the trees. We're widening out the fairways. We're putting more ground roll in. And that's where the industry is now.
It's incredible. It really is incredible. And it's so easy to, you know, you get to the course and you're excited to see your friends and you're just focused on enjoying your round and you forget to take in everything that's gone into it behind the scenes. So it's just, what an incredible way to look at everything. So thank you, Brad, for joining us and giving us your view on it, because it really is very different from how most people approach the course.
Most people approach a golf course as something they're going to conquer. I think you should approach it as a work of art to be appreciated.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time here.
See, you can keep things simple.
That was a good thing. Adam, I mean, My mind is still just racing because now I know over, you know, when I play next week and I'm standing over my first shot, I'm not going to have a million things in my head at the top of my swing. But that was just mind blowing to me.
I got to tell you, I love that dude. I love everything that he stands for, everything that he is. I swear to God, I could talk to him for hours because, first of all, the wealth of knowledge, that was just, that was 1% of what could come out of that brain. But I've never been a big golf architecture guy. I was one of those people at the beginning of the show that loves it for its beauty, right? I'll play some great course. I've been at Bandon Dunes. I've been at Sand Valley. I've been at all these great courses. And I, to myself, I'm like, oh, this is pretty. What a cool vista. And I really enjoy the course, but I never think about where should I put the ball? Where should I, you know, how is it going to roll? How should I hit up to it? I never think about any of that stuff, which is probably why I'm a hack. But it is incredibly exciting to hear both his passion, but some of those great names that we know in golf architecture that they had it right. I mean, that's got to give the old timers, hey, I don't know what we're doing. I told you this 50 years ago. This is how it's supposed to be. It's just so cool. And he's one of those personalities and minds that I think golf needs more of. And we talk about business of golf here and on the Stick and Hack show. We're about the stories and the history and that the things that people don't really ever talk about in golf as much. And he's one of them. And just, it was so, so exciting. I didn't think I was going to like it that much. I'm going to be honest with you. I know that sounds like...
Hey, stick with me. You trust me.
I do. But I'm like...
I promise you.
I will deliver. Architecture. Ugh, we're going to talk about golf architecture. But it was amazing.
It's a totally... You know, when you come to the game of golf, we all come to it for different reasons, right? It's like last week, Christina was like, listen, this is like my social time. I want to do it for fun. You know, my boyfriend, he likes to play competitive golf. He will literally sit down and look at, if he's going to a new course, he'll look at the website, look at each hole because he wants to score. Whereas I'm like, oh good, we're going to go play golf, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody's coming to it from a very different perspective. And I think one of the coolest things that we can do from our seats here is to take that lens and put it in different areas to say, but have you thought of this? Because that's where you really get to deepen your appreciation for the game and the industry as a whole and the tradition. But what I'm going to say next, I think will be very cool. So I hope you do too. And we'll get back with Brad because I think it would be really incredible for us to sit down in a cart with him and go through what that means when you're there. And 100%. We can put that on Stick and Hack. And it's a great, I mean, I'll tell you, when we did this at this walkthrough for our course reveal together in Mobile, my mind was blown as to what they had to take into consideration when restoring this course. And this is going on all across the country with these course restorations. Well, and so when you go to your course and you're like, hey, who changed the bunker? Why is that tree gone? We should move this. You know, it's true where we are now with all of the different organizations having their own, you know, greens committees and that kind of stuff. Steve, who works on Wall Street, doesn't necessarily know what that tree should be doing. So, you know, there needs to be an appreciation for the thought that goes into that.
Yeah. He's one of those repeats that, I mean, even an office hours or a Q&A with him on Stick and Hack as well. There's so much there. I love the walkthrough because whenever I see the behind the scenes of like when Jack opens a course or when some of these guys would open the course. In fact, there was a great 60 minutes. I'll have to see if I can find it and put it in the links. There's a 60 minutes that followed. His name escaped me. The guy, Pete Dye, who followed Pete Dye and Alice around and him explaining his vision and his reasoning behind things and standing there in the dirt. It's just a fascinating topic and one that doesn't get enough love, I think, in a cool Stick and Hack way, right? Which is boiled down, kind of simple. So great job, Brad Klein, the guest. It's so, so exciting. And thank you very much for bringing him here on the Business of Golf, Allison.
Well, it was a great conversation. And thanks for joining us here at the Business of Golf on the Stick and Hack Network. We'll see you again next week.